Tú me pones un hipótesis. Si tú no quieres hablar conmigo, dímelo para yo no llamarte ni molestarte, porque nada más quedaba tú.
Real talk. Real people. Real stories. The He's Just podcast. Yeah! Welcome, everyone, to another He's Just podcast. I'm your host and founder of the He's Just a Social Worker movement with another amazing show for you today. But before we get started, I want to remind everyone that this platform was built because way too often as people, we were overlooked or labeled. But this is no longer our plight, and our fight is for anyone and everyone who feels a need to be understood. We are strong as individuals, but unstoppable when we unite. I have two great guests today. First, let's meet Leticia Macias, legal assistant at Las Americas, an immigrant advocacy center in El Paso that provides accessible legal immigration services, including work permits and DACA assistance, particularly for victims of crime and domestic violence. Their Detained Deportation Defense Program offers legal support for immigrants detained by ICE in El Paso. Additionally, they deliver binational legal services in Mexico and the U.S., helping vulnerable immigrants, such as those with serious medical conditions, indigenous and Black immigrants, and members of the LGBTQ community to access the asylum system. Also meet attorney Zoe Bauman. She is the supervising attorney of the Detained Deportation Defense Team at Las Americas. She specializes in asylum and removal defense, offering pro-support to detain individuals in El Paso and New Mexico. Zoe holds a JD from Northeastern University School of Law. She has been recognized with the Program on Human Rights and Global Economy Fellowship and the National Lawyers Guild Hayward Burns Fellowship. Ladies, good morning and welcome to our show.
Good morning. Pleased to be here.
Well, I'll start with you, Leti. Tell us a little bit how you got involved in this work. Tell us a little bit about your journey.
Sure. I'm actually a retired teacher. I did 30 years. And early on, I knew I wanted to retire when I could because I wanted to go on missionary work. I did not know that my missionary work would lead me here to the plight of, you know, the border, the refugees. However, it was a thought that I always had because I did have a lot of children of immigrants. You know, my parents are immigrants themselves. And what really touched me was this particular instance where I had a very good rapport with this family. I had the daughter in my class, and from one day to the next, she disappeared. And so then a fellow family member came privately and told me that the family had gotten deported, and that just tore my heart because this child had been in the U.S. system. That's all she knew. On my journey, I said, how can I help? How can my missionary work help? COVID was a mixed blessing because at the time I attended my Mary Knoll retreat, discernment retreat. And it was there that I met one of the attorneys that volunteers. She's a Mary Knoll lay missioner that volunteers here at Las Americas. And because of COVID, everything stopped. So I stayed stationary in El Paso and I started helping her. Well, that was about 4.5 years ago. And so fast forward, this is God's plan for me. And I cannot tell you just how much it's so humbling to work with people, to be able to help, to accompany them in their plight, the emotions. I just know that this was where I was meant to be.
Mm. Thank you for your service. Zoe, same question for you. How did you get involved in this work? Tell us a little bit about your journey and your walk.
Yeah, for me, I had a teacher I was really close with in high school who taught ESL or English second language classes. And so I got to spend some time in her classroom doing some tutoring in high school, which kind of led to me teaching English night classes for refugees in Minneapolis when I was in college. And so that got me kind of into like wanting to learn more about issues facing refugees and asylum seekers and immigrants in the country. And so after I graduated college, I moved to Albuquerque, New Mexico, to start a job with the New Mexico Immigrant Law Center. And that was, I started that job just before Trump got elected. And so I really got to be working with this organization to think about how to respond to the needs of undocumented people in Albuquerque at the time, during a time that was like really felt scary and new and uncharted. So we started doing more DACA workshops and citizenship workshops. We went to a detention center in New Mexico as well to work with recently arrived asylum seekers. And that experience really motivated me to go to law school, where I got to focus on immigration law and led me to Las Americas.
Well, first and foremost, I want to thank you both for the great work that you do for all communities who do venture and visit you in Las Americas. Leti, what do you most enjoy about your job? And I know you shared your personal side a bit there, but what do you most enjoy about this work?
I enjoy being a beacon of hope for anyone that we come across, anyone that we touch. While detained, it was that visit, that wellness visit, that wellness check with our vulnerable people. They're scared, so many emotions, and their opportunity to just, you know, come out and do a visit with any of us, you know, with any of the assistance attorneys, is really uplifting for them. It really gives them a lot of hope. And I think just, you know, doing the wellness and trying to find, you know, any legal relief through the attorneys that we can, for me, is my biggest mission.
So I know that a lot goes into the planning of this. Someone is detained, or you are summoned by someone from your team, or there's someone else. Can you walk us through that process? How does that, how are you contacted and getting involved in the situation, if you will?
Yeah, I mean, I think El Paso and Southern New Mexico, the detention centers that we work on are unique because they're right on the border. And so when I talk to colleagues in New York or Chicago, I think those detention centers have people that are more local to the area oftentimes. But for us, we're working with people usually who have just crossed the border and have likely never been to the United States before and don't really, might not have any, might have really limited connections to the US, but it's rare that someone has like family locally in El Paso and someone that can be for them there. So we get calls from inside of the detention center asking for help. But we really also get calls from all over the country of, you know, worried family members who are in Boston or Chicago or somewhere else that are like looking for any kind of legal services or support for their loved ones that are inside the detention center. We partner with a few migrant shelters in the area. And so I think another way that we tend to get referrals and cases is that when a group of people cross the border, even if they cross together, it doesn't mean that they're all going to be treated the same. Some people might get released on parole and given like a court date kind of far out in the future. And then like their partner could be put into ICE detention center. So then we also get requests coming from those shelters.
You know, thankfully you guys are there to provide the support, but obviously we are saddened that these services have to exist in the way that they do, because many a times, me myself as a Latino, I also touch on that. You know, I'm an immigrant and I have family members who are immigrants as well. And to think about having a space where you can have, like Leti said, that beacon of hope, that we have that opportunity, it must be very chilling and cold for people who are detained and their families and their loved ones to really worry that they're in a place that they don't know no one. And you guys become that family extension, if you will. As a Latina yourself, Leti, how does that touch or make your work different in any way? The fact that you have that connection already to kind of support families as they're learning about the process, and you still want to provide that hope?
Yes, like I said, my parents were immigrants. I also have other family members that went through the same process, the same system. There's a lot of misconceptions on the immigration process here. And that's one of the things that I really try to dispel, those rumors. But I think that I can connect. I mean, it's the culture, the language, the fact, I think, that I was a teacher as well, and I had most of my students. I mean, I was a bilingual teacher. I taught English. That was my goal in elementary school. And I connected, like I said, I think the biggest factor is connecting with the culture. And then also my background as a teacher, you know, I was nurturing for 30 some years, and that radiates even if you're an adult. And so I think that is where I can really connect with them and then be able to talk to families, you know, wherever they're at, you know, thank goodness for WhatsApp. I can connect, families connected with me. I was like the, you know, the middle person between, you know, Zoe and, you know, the legalities, and then with the actual person. So lots of communication, and I think identification with me also being, you know, Hispanic Latina.
Thank you. So when it comes to some of these challenges that you are up against, you get a file, you start to read through or get information, whether it is from one of the partnering agencies, what's that turnaround for you? Like, how quick are you trying to make things happen? Like, someone is detained on the weekend, does that change the aspect of the case? Do you have to wait till Monday? What does that look like?
Yeah, I guess I just want to back up by talking about maybe like a common misconception, because in our criminal justice system, right, everyone who can't afford a lawyer gets appointed a lawyer. And so everyone has some kind of representation. But when you're going through immigration proceedings, that's not the case. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's like thousands of people detained in our ICE, in our region. And like, you know, so many people just aren't going to have like any representation at all. And we're one of two nonprofits that are providing legal services in the El Paso area. And I'm one of two attorneys that are doing this work within Las Americas. And so the scope and the scale of the problem is just like so much bigger than what we are able to handle. Mm. And so I'm not always representing people in court or providing that kind of direct service. Very oftentimes, like what we're doing is providing information to people about their rights, what they can expect, kind of helping them like understand what the process is going to look like. Because I think the most difficult thing for a lot of people and a lot of who are in detention and a lot of families is the uncertainty, because ICE can treat two people with the exact same, in the exact same situation, very, very differently. So unfortunately, we're just not able to respond the moment that we get a referral, because the volume of need is just so high. So I think like when I take a case, how I respond just depends on like so many different factors. But if I am able to represent someone in immigration court, I would say about like the length of their court proceedings while in detention is about 3 months. So what I'll really do is start by having, you know, working with them myself, or having someone like Letty go in and really understand the facts of their story and how it might fit into like U.S. asylum law. And then you move on to gathering evidence. So it could be having them undergo like a psychological evaluation with one of our pro bono partners. We collect letters of support that will like corroborate the story from friends and family members in the U.S. and very oftentimes in the home country. We'll put together pretty extensive research that we call like country conditions research, so that we can kind of educate the judge and educate the government attorney that, yes, the things that they're saying is also like reflected in this human rights report or this State Department report, especially since, you know, there's lots of people right now from Venezuela, from Mexico, but really we see people from all over the world, including different parts of Asia and West Africa. So very oftentimes we're really trying to like understand the cases ourselves and then be able to educate the judge so we can get a positive outcome for the client. And all of that can take a really long time. Also, oftentimes when I'm representing someone, we're fighting to get them out of detention before they have to go all the way through their court proceedings, because we know they're much more likely to be granted asylum and get that positive outcome if they're able to do it outside of a prison setting, and be connected with loved ones and additional resources and have more time to really prepare their case. So what Letty did very often with me was talk to their family members and loved ones in the United States and collect sponsor documents showing ICE that, you know, they have a place to go in the United States and that so they should be released while their case is pending.
Thank you for putting that into context for us. And still in all, even if you can't represent, it sounds like you guys are juggling so much in so little time. And again, positive energy to you and to your team to be able to do this, because unfortunately, you guys are the lifeline of a family member who may have never been detained before. And we still don't know what the circumstances are, why they did try to enter the country. We really don't know the facts. And having you guys there to kind of support that work, I think, improves their ability to understand the process, because lots of what's there is, I don't understand the language. What's going to happen to me next? We don't know, because there are some cases that are very tricky. Family members or people are running away from gang violence and other issues in their homeland countries. And when they do try to come in and they're detained, kind of things change in a different way for them. So Letty, how difficult is it when you do visit and when you visit potential clients and they're sharing out their stories? I know that you've heard a lot of those stories, but how difficult is it for you to kind of tease out what the facts are to keep them calm and so that they can learn more about what the next steps are?
Okay. When I go in there, or when I used to, I'm now in a different department, but what I would do, first of all, is check their wellness. You know, are they being treated right? They're getting food. You know, their rights are being respected. And then we do what's called an intake, you know, looking into their cases and so forth. However, disclaimer, sometimes the person would be so distraught. I remember this particular case. This woman was just so emotional. Just so emotional. I just let her, let it all out. And I'm there patiently listening to her. And then if, you know, even saying a prayer together, you know, that just that beacon of hope. And then once, you know, once I allow them to just air out everything that they're feeling, their process, how they're doing there in ICE, then, you know, I get the facts of the intake and I write them all down. And then once I get back to the office, you know, then I used to consult with Zoe, you know, with the attorney, and go over any forms of relief. If I needed to contact parents or sponsors, rather, or family members, especially if there was a communication issue for the detainee, for the person, then I would make sure that I would make time that same day to connect with the person, give them my contact information, and try and ease communication with them. Or if rights were being violated, then working with Zoe, you know, we would make civil rights complaints, you know, against it. So it just depended on the individual circumstance.
You know, having that opportunity to listen in, I can visualize how difficult this is for all stakeholders, the detainee, and also for yourself to be able to lend yourself in a way that you are their therapist at that time. You are their family member. You're every person that they can think of, because they have an opportunity to vent out how nice it is to at least have a person who's willing to try to listen and give them opportunity, which I think is the best step in this. But Zoe, when there's a situation where Letty or another team member comes back to you and says, there's some issues here, their rights are being violated, what is that process for you? And what do you do when you listen to those words?
Yeah, I think it's really central to our team's mission to not just be looking out for what we can do for someone's immigration outcome, but also to be really paying attention to the conditions inside that are impacting people. And so there's a couple of different government oversight agencies that you can make complaints to. So we'll like help people file those complaints, or I'll file the complaint as their attorney so that there can be some kind of like investigation and accountability to what's going on inside. I think all too often we're seeing cases of medical neglect for people inside, which can have really tragic and devastating consequences. I've also had clients experience anti-LGBTQ harassment at the hands of ICE officials, which I think when you're already so vulnerable is just devastating to the clients that we work with. So we try to use the mechanisms that are available to us, but I think also we're a group that's not afraid to go to the media when we have a story to share, because we know that these internal government accountability mechanisms are not always going to be able to like make change. So we'll talk about things with the press, and we also really connect our work to broader advocacy to end ICE detention in the state of New Mexico by working with the Dignity Not Detention Coalition.
Well, big up to you guys again in Las Americas and agencies that do bring that fight back, because I understand that, all due respect, there is a process to this and everyone is entitled to that opportunity. And you guys, obviously, and your team offer this chance. I'm going to ask a question for the both of you here. Just reading out of a stat, about 63,000 or close to 64,000 immigrant court deportation cases were completed in June 2024. Of those, judges issued about 25,000 removal orders. That's about 41%. I'll start with you, Zoe. Does that number seem accurate? Do you feel that there is more, or is that status quo as far as what the process is, give or take?
Yeah, I mean, I believe that number is accurate. I will say like the percentage of people that are ordered deported really varies depending on where you are geographically. And so I think like the judges where we're at the detention centers in Otero and El Paso have like a much lower asylum grant rate than that. And so I think like that national average too is probably taking into account people who are mainly people who are outside of detention and are able to get like more resources together so they can really fight their case and have the opportunity to explain to a judge what happened to them. But I think where we're at, you know, it's a far higher percentage of people that end up with deportation orders if they're forced to go through their whole court proceedings while they're detained.
Same question for you, Letty. Looking at it from the scope of we as Latinos, you know, we're big novelas, we're big on news, we're big on secondhand information. Mm-hmm. How does it look like and feel like for you and also for the people that you are supporting? Is that number accurate?
I would say it is. And I'd just like to say that for those clients that did get their deportation orders, you know, when I would come back and do that, the visit, you know, I just make sure that I connected with family members. You know, that's hard. That's, you know, hard information. And so I always circled back to their family members, giving back the information that I got directly from Zoe and the reasons why. And just making sure that they, you know, the transition back home And then just explaining to them, I said, you now have a voice. You speak to your, you know, our fellow people, because there's so many misconceptions that, hey, it'll be easy, this and that. But the reality is that it's harsh. It's very harsh. Not only the travel here, but the having to navigate all this immigration policy that's so unfair, our broken system. So I think, like I said, my job at that point would be to you go back and talk, you know, habla con la gente, talk to the people and tell them that it's not easy. It's not going to be easy. You know, don't listen to misconceptions. Try and get your information from reputable orgs so that you know what reality is. So that was an opportunity for me. And aside from, you know, again, once again, letting them cry it out. I mean, men and women, you know, sometimes men would cry really hard. You know, it's harsh. It's harsh being in a detained situation. It's cold. It's, you know, unfair. So,
you know, coming from a male perspective, and we come from our countries with big hopes, with big plans. And I understand that migrating to a place that people don't identify as it being yours, some of the things we have to deal with in our third world countries, just everyday life, finding a job is difficult. Feeding your family is difficult. Getting an education properly is difficult. So I do commend and understand those men that do have to step out and try their best to provide for their families. Albeit the risks, the scenarios, those things become secondhand. And then when such a thing hits, I do understand that there is a lot of tears that come down, but a lot of them may be related to that sense of, I let my family down. I took a lot of risks. I did something I shouldn't have done. I put my family back in the hole. And those tears may be of motivation to continue to move forward, because the Latino man is proud. In many cases, we try our best to provide for our families. And when situations like this arise, that the family is distraught and we don't know where we are, it can become difficult. So again, these things that you guys offer our families and the detainees is just priceless. Zoe, do you ever feel that you are in danger in your job? I know that there's a lot of misconceptions, if you will, about some of the people, whether it is what they call coyotes or cartel people. Is that a thing where they contact your agency in any way to put fear of the people that got caught or not? Is that something?
You know, we're really fortunate that that hasn't happened to us. I think for us, the scariest thing being in Texas is like the fear of like white nationalists and anti-immigrant groups who might have some kind of vendetta against a group like us who's dedicated to providing free legal services to recently arrived immigrants. I feel like that's been a fear more than the coyotes or other folks. I know it is like a huge fear for a lot of people. Like you were saying, it's like people have sacrificed everything to make this journey. And it definitely is a fear for some folks, especially who are just will be sent back to Mexico right across the border and close to where their coyote might have been. But yeah, no, we're lucky and haven't had any of those kind of threats.
Well, good. Leti, in your case, when you're hearing, you know, family members or detainees, are they in fear in some way of something that may have happened?
Yes, that's always in the back of their minds. I do recall in 2023, we had a situation of a shooting, a crime, Hudspeth crimes. And that day that I went to make contact, you know, with them at the detention center, and I gave them all, you know, my work cell. The biggest thing that I had to do after work was connecting with the families, you know, the crying wives, the mothers, the, you know, uncles, aunts. You know, it's just very painful, you know, and in this line of work, I always put myself in their shoes. I'm like, you know, what do I need? What would I need? How would I want to be treated? And so anyhow, yeah, it's very heartbreaking, very emotional. And I think the fact that I'm very spiritually religious and grounded, I think also helps. But yeah, everything that I echo to what Zoe said, you know, that's just very real here in Texas. So just telling, you know, the moms, you know, your son is complete. He's all complete. There's nothing missing. No physical abuse that I saw. Those are the kinds of things that, you know, they want to know. You know, is he eating? Is, you know, and like I said, I being a mother myself, of course, you know, I radiate to that. I connect with that. And I think that's what gives them a little bit of peace, if you will, to know that your loved ones they're detained, but they're, you know, they're eating physically. They look well. And yeah, you know, it's just a hard situation.
I'll stay with you here, Leti, in that thinking about this progression, if you will. How do you view when a person is first detained and now you and the team begin to work with this person and family? How is that progression as they continue to now understand what's going on a little bit more? Can you tell us about that timeline and how that works mentally for those of us who are detained, that start period, and how do they deal throughout?
Once we get started and I connect with family members and, you know, documents need to be quickly, you know, sent to me, then somewhere along the process, something may become difficult for them to attain. And then, you know, the person detained, you know, starts losing hope. Maybe I should, you know, go back to my country. We're not going to get the documents, and vice versa with the family members. Zoe and I did experience this with some of our people, but I'm very happy to say that, you know, in the end, we were able to navigate through that. Like I said, sometimes it's allowing them to cry. That's okay. And then I'm here being their cheerleader, their beacon of hope. Si se puede, we can do this. Mm-hmm. And so I can think of right off the bat, two cases that we thought were almost nearly impossible. One case for three times, was it, Zoe, for this particular person that they denied, you know, her parole. And, you know, we just kept at it. You know, Zoe is an amazing, amazing fighter. And so, yeah. You know, they still connect with me. These people still connect with me post. And so, you know, you have to give that beacon of hope, especially, you know, between, you know, Zoe and I. We know that this is possible. We can get the document. Let's, you know, just kind of like being there for them, pushing them along. Family members, it falls really on family members to get all these documents. Don't give up hope, you know, just get it. You know, who do I need to connect with? And so, you know, I would even go as far as helping them out to make calls. And so el que puede, si puede, you know, we can do this. So, yeah.
Yes, we can. Thank you so much for like keeping up that fight, guys. You know, the one thing that I'm listening to within your answer is that it's like a grieving process, right? We go through this bargaining, we're in denial, you know, we go through acceptance. There's so much that happens throughout this timeline. And again, it could be because I've been through the process before, or it could be a scenario that this is my first time and I don't have nothing to fall back on. And my line of hope and that fear comes in, and there's so much that comes into play. So I can see that you and the team continuously encouraging and making sure that everything is set the right way, because it comes down to logistics and what are the information that is missing or needed to make it go that next step. So as an attorney, how is it for you that you and another person have to juggle so many? What's the fear of burnout for you in this process? And why do you keep fighting so hard?
Yeah, thank you for that question. And I just wanted to add off of what Leti was saying too. I think she's such a gift for folks inside, and she's always telling us, like in our team meetings, like, oh, and then this person just like broke down and cried and were like, Letty, that's because you're like the mom of the team. And like people really open up to her and I think respond to her in a really different and beautiful way. But in I think in terms of why I want to keep doing this work, and I think how a lot of us who have been at Las Américas for a while feels, there's the term vicarious trauma, and you know that you can kind of absorb someone else's trauma from having to kind of relive those things with them, and that can be really hard to kind of have to go through really horrible stories of you know, sexual assault and, you know, physical and psychological violence. But I think the flip side of that coin is that there's also so much vicarious resilience. And we're very often getting to meet with, I think, just incredibly brave and selfless and dedicated people who have, you know, sacrificed everything to come to the United States and have often had to do so because they're speaking out against a repressive government or an abusive partner. And you know how what they've done is incredible. And so to also get to feel like you get to be a part of that story, I think is really life-giving. And I think for me, I'm thinking of one client we worked with was from very rural Guatemala and spoke Quechua and a little bit of Spanish, and was essentially imprisoned in her home by her abuser. And to get to really let her tell her story in her own words and kind of work with her to the point where she had the confidence to do that in a courtroom in a high stakes scenario and then see her win asylum was it's such a beautiful and transformative experience.
You know, you guys just triggered something in me, because one of the things that gets me boiled is the following. As a teacher myself, as a school administrator myself, the biggest issue, right? Here's a person who has already dealt the system, had to leave their country, escaping, goes through a situation, she and her children or child make it here. And as a school system, we enter this child into the regular protocol, assessments, figuring out how things are. Sometimes they don't have the opportunity to figure out what is wrong with them. What are things that they can recall? A student enters here under those circumstances, and the mom may or may not have shared, depending on her cognitive abilities to hold information and whatnot. You think about a child who comes into the country and shortly after he or she are being tested for lost links, and their social behavior doesn't match what the school is expecting, or their social behaviors are not matching what society expects them to have. And then this mom, who still is here, broken, has to clean whatever job she can find, if she's lucky to have family members that she can do babysitting, the language is not there. So think about the threat that even though that you guys can be that bridge for them, some of our families still come here and struggle. And they struggle in the biggest ways. And that's why we, people who look like us and understand the process, are deeply hurt by these stories. Because when the children have to grow up with this trauma and what they have seen or learned in the hands of their fathers, many times of other men or whatnot, is the behaviors that they're going to carry on with. So this is extremely difficult for us as well, because as a Latino, when I see my people enter the country and still be talked about saying that they can't accomplish something and still have to have that target on them, is extremely difficult. So know that the work that you guys have done for them, at least in that short period of time that you work with them, is priceless, because sometimes they enter here and don't share. They keep it under the wraps, and it's extremely difficult. Now, for you, Zoe, can you tell us a little bit about the asylum process? How does that work and what goes into play for this?
Good question. I mean, are you looking for like kind of to understand like what, how a person would like meet the requirements of asylum law, or kind of like what the life of a case would look like?
In both circumstances, I think that many of our listeners who either don't understand the process, they're trying to support family members here, go to the church, seek asylum, go here, go there. Is there like a way to understand this that's easier?
Yeah, I think I can talk a little bit about how I would like explain asylum to someone who's, you know, I come across in detention. But I think something that I try and communicate right away is that asylum law unfortunately doesn't cover everyone who's like afraid to go back to their home country, or even everyone who's already experienced really severe harm in their home country. That harm has to be connected to a particular characteristic you have, whether that's your political opinion or your race or your nationality. There's what's called in asylum law that you're a part of a particular social group that your own society sees as distinct. So I think a classic example of that is being gay or being trans. You're part of a group in your society that people in, let's say, Guatemala would see as their own distinct group. And then you have to connect the harm that you experienced at, or that you're afraid you will experience if you're returned to your home country, to that specific characteristic. And that can be really, really hard, especially for so many people who are fleeing gang and cartel violence and extortion. They're saying, oh, how they might frame it is, oh, this has happened to everyone in my town, so there's no escaping it, and I had to flee. And then you have to work with people and help them understand or think through whether that harm might also, they might have been singled out for harm because of a certain characteristic that they themselves have. You then
that's
also-
That's a great explanation, because it sounds hand in hand with how we interpret it. I'm thinking about, you know, the parent of a student who attends school, we often relay the word bullying to a misunderstanding that the student had with another student. And sometimes we need to unpack it a bit to really understand what are the layers behind that. So thank you for really giving us a little bit of what that is. I know each case is different, but it's a great opportunity for us to understand what's in and what's out when it refers to that. Letty, when we are thinking about the families who are detained, and that's maybe a misconception or myth, if a child and a mother or a family are detained, is the child detained in a separate location? Are the families together? Is one allowed to go this way or that way? How does that work out?
Okay, I think for this question, I'm going to go ahead and defer to Zoe.
Take it away, Zoe.
It really depends on the situation. I think oftentimes what happens if like a mom comes in with kids, they'll go into like a border patrol, or people call it the Hilera area, together, and they're held there for like a few days and then will be released and given like a future court date and a future check-in with ICE. And then for children who enter alone or who are entering with like another adult in their life, sometimes they will be separated and the child gets sent to, it's not the same as an ICE detention center. It's run by the Office of Refugee Resettlement. And so it's like an area for kids where children are held. And then there are people at that center who work to connect them to their family members in the US. But I think very tragically, we are still seeing the separation of parents and children at the border. I have a client right now who entered the United States with her 14-year-old son. And then without explaining why or anything else, they took her to a jail, and then they took her son into, you know, into the essentially the baby jail, as what they've been called, of in the Office of Refugee Resettlement. And he was there for months and was eventually released to live with family members, but his mother is still detained and there's no real substitute for her being there with her 14-year-old child, especially as he's about to start school in September, you know, in late August for the very first time. And just, you know, seeing her mental state right now is really heartbreaking, and just her feeling that she's failed her children somehow because of this, the state violence of separating parents and their kids.
Well, we're going to send positive energy to the family, and hopefully this finds a resolution. Can't even think about how difficult this is for this family and how difficult it must be for the child to not have his mom at this particular moment. Is so difficult. Letty, are there, and I know you started off with this, but are there cases that really resonate for you? I know you started your career with such a case, but you've seen so many. Are there cases that really stick out for you that you're like, oh no, this is the one that gets me like really upset or motivates you? Is there such a case that you can remember that really drives you to say, this is the reason why I get up every day to do this work?
Yes. There was a particular case for an individual that Zoe and I worked. It seemed like all the roadblocks were there for this person's release. And so many cases came out of his case. I'm going to call him Johnny from Venezuela. And he was detained for several months. And in the beginning, he was very motivated. But then as roadblocks starting to happen, he's like, you know what? I quit. I don't want to do this anymore. No, no, no. And then me coming back with Zoe, oh no, this is what's happening. And she's like, oh no, no, we need to convince him. So, you know, Zoe would interfere, call him, and then I would go. And in the end, he was released and he's thriving. He's working. And I think about that because there were so many roadblocks to his case, but yet it happened. He was liberated from detention. And I'm not sure if his case is complete, Zoe. I defer to you for that. I think you know who I'm talking about. And, you know, we still connect here and there. I think there's like four clients that were particularly difficult trying cases, but we hung on in there with them. And post-release, they're doing wonderful. And when we connect, you know, it's humbling to know that they're very grateful. But what these people don't know is that, my gosh, they taught us so much. The resiliency, navigating new waters into the legal realm, and just as human beings, you know, just as human beings, how it is so important to have that connection with someone, that accompaniment with anyone. So totally, if anyone is out there wanting to be a volunteer to work in an org, I would really encourage them to accompany detained people. You know, get yourself vetted so that you can accompany detained individuals, because, you know, which one of us would like to be locked up? No, none of us. But when we see another, you know, another human being, that warmth, that, you know, beacon, that, you know, it just makes things easier, and it makes you want to, you know, continue fighting for your case.
I'm going to stay here with you, Letty. Is there anything that we can do as a community? Is there a website? Are there things that we can do to support community members that are detained in any way?
Wow. You know what? There is, but I think this is something that we can get back to you. Talking to my current team, I work now with affirmative cases, and then connecting with the detained team. I'm sure we can come up with a list of ways that you can help. I know that particular church groups around this area have also volunteered. We do have people that from local churches that I know detained team has one that accompanies the individuals. Like I said, it visits. We have religious organizations, I do know that for sure, that go out. But totally, if a person wants to be associated, I think it would be easier to go in either with a group, a religious group, or with an org like ours. You know, just get in contact with the org and see if, you know, they can see about getting vetted. You do have to get vetted. You know, there's a background check, there's permissions and so forth. And then, yes, I know that the detained team, I don't know how volunteers are with the detained team, but we did have individuals that were willing to go and do what we call an intake, which is basic, you know, facts and information when they go visit the individual that's detained. So, yeah.
Mm. So I'm going to ask you a question, and you kind of highlighted this a bit. Everyone has a person, and I'm going to say you two guys seem to be a dynamic duo. How valuable is Letty to you? And are you able to get your work done had you not had Letty? Let us know.
Definitely wouldn't have been able to get my work done without Letty. Yeah, she's such a gift to Las Americas because, you know, I think our ability to connect with our clients is the whole ball game, because that's how, I mean, of course, providing them that, you know, that support and showing them that we're going to be there for them builds trust, so we can actually get the most important facts for their legal case too, and give them the best legal representation possible. But you can't really do that without like a foundation of care and support. And so having someone who's on the ground and can really empathize with people is just so valuable. And I think Letty and a lot of the, you know, the other legal assistants at Las Americas too are really smart and quickly come to an understanding of the best way to, you know, different helping creatively think through options for clients and how to, you know, push from within and the government, but also how to think bigger picture strategy about ending immigrant detention. So I really appreciate that.
Well, you guys are awesome. Letty, before we let you go, the floor is yours. Any parting words you would have for our audience and our listeners who may endure this process and have to have support, whether it is in El Paso or anywhere else, what can you tell them?
I would say, don't give up. Don't give up. Try and keep your perspective. Be focused, especially when you're needing to get documents, when you're needing to connect with family members to get those documents, to legal assistance, to the attorneys. Persevere. This is a time for faith. I've actually encountered an individual that had a complete transformation. And just yesterday I was talking to him, and he's still very religious, very grounded. So yes, it's a matter of just, you know, not giving up that hope. Don't throw in the towel quickly, you know, just persevere, continue going forward, reach out to the assistants, to the attorney, low moments, because it can be done. You know, if your case especially does have a form of immigration relief, then stick with it. Don't give up. Continue. And for those that are thinking of coming around, you know, taking the trek over here, yes, it's going to be dangerous. It's, you know, it's not easy. It's definitely not easy, but totally, if you can get here, you have relief, then go forth. You know, we all have a story, and every story is valuable, but, you know, don't give up. If you came here, don't give up easily there, because I've seen that also. If you came here, you made that trek, then follow through. At least you have that satisfaction that you followed through. And even if it doesn't work out for you, you can go back to your family knowing that you did everything that was possible.
That's right. Don't give up. Mm-hmm. So same for you. Any parting words? Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today. Any parting words for our listeners about the process, about you and this movement?
Yeah, I mean, the process is so unfair, and I have so much respect and admiration for the people that come over here and are willing to just put it all on the line to give their family, their children, a better life. So it is a long process, and it's a difficult process. But yes, all the love to folks in that situation.
What a dynamic duo. Thank you, friends. Remember, friends, do not give up. Progress isn't about reaching your goals. It's about the journey, your growth, and the countless experiences along the way. Continue everything you do, but do it with courage. Because on this platform it was built, because way too often as people, we were overlooked or labeled. But this is no longer our plight, and our fight is for anyone and everyone who feels a need to be understood. We are strong as individuals, but unstoppable when we unite. Tune in, friends, to another He's Just a Social Worker show coming to another town near you real soon. We're out. Thank you, friends.
Please note that the views expressed here are my own and not a representation of my employers and clients. Thank you for listening. We're always here for you. Just message us and we'll get back to you within 24 hours. Thank you. More than just at He's Just a Social Worker. In memory of my mother, Matilde De La Rosa, this is dedicated to you, Mom. Miss you so much. En memoria de mi madre, Matilde De La Rosa, esto va dedicado a ti, mamá. Te extraño mucho.